This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up on February 11th is going to be the ordination and in turn the liturgy for the fifth bishop of the Diocese of Gary here in Northwest Indiana. We have with us now the two people that know what the procedure is going to be the best, what's happening on February 11th. We have Father Marty Dobrinsky and we have Father Mike Yadrin. Father Dobrinsky is one of the organizers of the liturgical event coming up, and Father Mike Yadrin is the current administrator for the diocese. He took over when Bishop Donald Hying left to become the bishop in Madison, Wisconsin, back in last April, and he is going to, in turn, help guide, I guess, the new bishop to the job that he is going to be taking on, leading a very, very active and very populous Diocese of Gary. And Father Marty and Father Mike, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
You're welcome. Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
First, Father Marty, I'll let you give us an idea of what the event coming up on February 11th is going to look and sound like.
Well, February 11th will be the ordination and installation of Bishop-elect McClory, and it will be quite an event. It's the Cathedral seats, you know, a little less than 800. And so that means that we have to watch the number of people coming. So it's a ticketed event, but it's going to be broadcast on the Internet through our website, mm-hmm. and on EWTN and Catholic television.
Wow.
And which are both cable channels. And I think we're working on trying to make an arrangement for a later broadcast on Lakeshore television, mm-hmm. As well. But so we're very excited about it, and been a lot of planning going into it and a lot of work in preparation for it. And we will begin with around 2:00 in the afternoon. We have some 40-some bishops presently that are going to be there, over 100 priests and deacons as well. It's about 60 deacons. And then probably close to 800 guests that we will shoehorn into the cathedral for the event. So each parish has two representatives coming. And then there are representatives for the religious communities, the sisters, etc., and also then the bishop's elect's family and his family and close associates from Detroit who will be coming down for the event as well. So it'll be a pretty packed event, and it pretty much looks like if you've ever been to a ordination of a priest, it pretty much looks the same. So we begin Mass as usual, and then after the Gospel is read, the bishop is introduced by one of our priests, one of our youngest priests. Father Declan McNichols will be one of the assisting priests for the bishop-elect, and he will introduce him to the Archbishop of Indianapolis, who is the main celebrant for the beginning part of the Mass. Mm-hmm. The Archbishop of Indianapolis, Archbishop Thompson, is our provincial. Each collection of dioceses is put into a province. For most of us, it's a state. So for us, it's the state of Indiana, and the Archbishop is the Archbishop of Indianapolis. So he has the permission or what have you. He's the one who does the ordaining. And so he will be presented to the Archbishop by Father Declan, and then the whole thing proceeds from there. So it's very interesting, and I would suggest to people, if they're really to watch it online, and also you'll be able to download online a PDF of the Mass program. And the good thing about in the program for the Mass is there is very nice little explanations of all the different things that are going to happen during the ordination rite itself.
Well, I guess the sports analogy was you can't tell the players without a scorecard, right?
And, that's right. Can't tell the players without
right.
a program.
Yeah, that's right. That's
so
right.
Yeah, so it'll be a good guide for all of that. Mm-hmm. In addition, on the night before, there is an evening prayer, which is customary, that happens, and at the evening prayer will be not at the cathedral, it will be at St. Michael's in Schererville, which is the second of our two parishes dedicated to the angels, which are the patrons of the diocese. And at the evening prayer, too, you'll be able to download that program as well. And though St. Michael's is a bigger church, it's still we still have tickets, you know, but there's a little larger parish representation at that, et cetera, et cetera. But we encourage people to really go online and just enjoy and pray together online for those events as well.
Now, Father Marty, did you have an opportunity to participate in helping organize the last one, which was for Bishop Hying?
Yes.
What was it? Will we find the same similarities in the programs, the events?
It'll be substantially different because Bishop Hying came to us already ordained as a bishop.
Yeah.
So this is substantially different from the very get-go. That liturgy at the very beginning, there's all kinds of things that happen before we even do the readings where he takes possession of the diocese and et cetera, et cetera. In this liturgy, Bishop-elect McClory is sitting right outside the presbytery if you in the cathedral, so he'll be between the altar and the bishop's chair, flanked by two assisting priests. So he's still a priest. And so the whole first half of the liturgy is presided over by Archbishop Thompson through the ordination rite. And then after the ordination rite, which happens pretty much like after the homily, he is now the bishop. And now he becomes the main celebrant of the liturgy.
That's interesting.
So it's very, very different than just an installation.
The other thing that's substantially different about it, too, is that we're going to have oodles more bishops here, because when it's a bishop being transferred from one diocese to another, they merely come in to take possession of the diocese, and you might have a couple of visiting bishops, but not many. However, when a priest is being ordained a bishop, there are a lot of bishops that attend the ceremony, so we've got a lot more of that going on as well.
Father Mike, tell us a little bit about what you as the administrator of the diocese, kind of being the mediary, I guess, between the former bishop, Bishop Hying, and now the bishop-elect, Bishop McClory, coming in. What kinds of things do you get to do to help prepare Bishop-elect McClory for his new role?
As soon as he was named a bishop by the Pope, the Apostolic Nuncio called me to let me know who our new bishop was going to be and instructed me to call him so that we could have our initial conversation as well as set the date for the announcement. From the very beginning, we were working about his public announcement, what he was going to be doing, when he could come in. I've been in conversation with him several times by phone, many more times text or email, in order to get him ready. When he came in for his announcement, you know, we had the press conference, and then after the press conference, he had mass for our pastoral center staff so that he could meet the people that are going to be working with him. And after that, we went to visit a school, and we went to see the cathedral where he was going to be ordained. So there was a lot just in that first day. And then, as I say, in initial conversations, just kind of trying to bring him up to speed on some of the things that are happening, but there's not going to be any way to bring anybody up to speed until they're actually here. You know, it's kind of like being a bishop. One of the first things I learned in these past several months, it's like jumping into the deep end of the pool. You know, you just got to jump in and hope he can swim.
Well,
so
that's
I'll be
good.
There to back him up, you know, with whatever he might need. And I'm sure I'll be around for a little bit of a while, you know, just to give him history and context on some of the decisions that have been made or some of the programs that we're doing, and just do the best I can to support him in his role as our bishop.
I know that I'm sure he's very interested, and you've kept him up to speed on what's happening with the school system within the Diocese of Gary, and the Big Shoulders Fund, and the program is being established with the help of the folks here in Northwest Indiana to make the school system stronger and much better. So he's, I'm sure, very excited about getting involved in that.
He is. He's very committed to Catholic education, which excites all of us. And that's one of the reasons why his first visit, he wanted it to be at a school. And he's very excited about Big Shoulders coming in to help us. So they're going to be able to provide a lot of work for us and help for us in terms of, like, some of professional development and other kind of issues. In other dioceses, they provide a lot more cash benefits. Since our diocese, we're in Indiana, so we can benefit from the voucher program, a lot of the money that Big Shoulders is going to be giving to our diocese will go in terms of professional development, in terms of looking for good administrators, in helping the teachers, you know, those kinds of things. So it's something all the schools can benefit from.
Now let me ask, Father Mikey, is there a website that people can check if they'd like to check it ahead of the February 11th ordination and the installation of the new bishop?
Oh, yeah, they can go to the diocesan website. It's www.dcgary.org, and there's a link for the ordinations right there.
We're speaking with Father Mike Adron. He's the administrator for the Diocese of Gary until the bishop-elect McClory is ordained and takes over, and also with Father Marty Dobrinsky, who is, along with others, working on getting the liturgical events lined up. That's going to happen on February 11th at the Cathedral in Gary. Robert McClory has been a student, a lawyer, a seminarian, a pastor, and a chancellor, and now he is taking on a new challenge as the fifth bishop of the Diocese of Gary. Bishop McClory, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's a delight to be with you, Chris, and hearty hello and blessings to all your listeners.
Thank you very much. I've had an opportunity to take a look at some of the information about your background, not only personal background, but also, too, about your religious background. Tell us first, I guess, about yourself and the position that you are coming from there in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Yeah, so currently I serve as the pastor and the rector of the National Shrine of the Little Flower, which is a basilica in Royal Oak, Michigan. It's a large and vibrant parish. We have 4,500 families. We've got a beautiful and historical edifice, along with pre-K through 12 high school. So it's a wonderful place to serve the people of God, and hopefully it's prepared me to serve an even wider flock in Northwest Indiana.
I have a very extensive Catholic education, starting from grade school there in Detroit and moving on to other schools as well. You moved on, I guess, into secular college, I understand, in fact, into a secular career. Tell us what prompted you to make the shift from college, and included attending University of Michigan and get a law degree and a practice in law, into, I guess, the calling for the priesthood.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. You know, even in my study of the law, and I had previously studied public policy with some interest in economic development, I always looked for ways to be of service, to try and make a contribution to the greater good. And so certainly that expressed itself in some interest in the law and public policy. And I think as my journey of faith continued to grow, what I realized is that the most important thing that I can give people is really the loving outreach that God wants us all to give. And so I began to reflect more fully on what God might be calling me to, and certainly I think he uses all of our background, and so my background in law and in public policy hopefully will serve as well as I'm in a pastoral role in the Diocese of Gary. But that motivation just continued to grow and express itself, and I thought, if I gave myself completely to serving Jesus in the ministry, I think that's really the best way that God would use me to have an impact on the lives of others.
When you took up the priesthood, was ordained as a priest in May of 1999, did you have any thought at all about the possibility that you would end up being a bishop?
I did not. You know, this is something that just comes suddenly, and your life has changed in an instant. And so, really, I had no idea until I received a phone call from someone called the Papal Nuncio. It's like the Pope's ambassador to the United States, but also his delegate to the church in the United States. And he called me up and said, "The Holy Father has appointed you the Bishop of Gary." And I said, I knew it was Gary. He said, "Gary." I said, "I am delighted." And I said, "If that's the Holy Father's wishes, I'll be happy to fulfill that." I said, "I don't think I'm worthy, but if the Holy Father wants me, then I'll do my best." And so he was very grateful for that. And my life was suddenly changed, and all changed for the good. The people of Gary have been so loving and kind and supportive, and the people of the region that I've had a chance to encounter have genuinely given me the love and embrace, which I'm very grateful for.
One of the things I noticed in getting ready for our conversation was that it's interesting that you, being the Bishop of McClory, will be when your ordination happens here in February, as actually going to be Gary's second bishop with some Detroit ties. You being a native of Detroit and the region and in Michigan, it's interesting that Bishop Dale Melchick, who was the bishop previous to you back, was also involved in the priesthood in Detroit.
Yes, and for me, that's been just a tremendous blessing. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to meet and converse with Bishop Melchick on several occasions. He certainly had an excellent reputation in Detroit for his service here. And then, you know, from afar, not too far away, Detroit and Gary aren't that far away, the opportunity to just really appreciate and admire all that he's done there. One of the special blessings that the timing of my announcement as the bishop was just before something called an ad limina visit, which is a visit of the bishops of a particular region to Rome to meet with the Pope and also to pray at some of the holy sites. So during that occasion, which was a week in Rome, I was with Bishop Melchick during that time, as well as Bishop Donald Hying, who had immediately succeeded Bishop Melchick for the last 5.5 years. And so that was a wonderful way to be kind of welcomed into the fraternity that is in Gary.
Had you had the chance ever to visit Vatican City in the past, or was that your first visit?
Well, it was the first time that I met Pope Francis. I did study in Rome, so I was there for 5 years. During that time, it would have been St. John Paul II. So it was a real treat to be able to meet Pope Francis, and not just meet him, but we were in a setting where he meets with groups of bishops. So there were about 25 of us bishops from Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And we had about a two-and-a-half-hour meeting with Pope Francis, which was a real delight.
In the transition here from being involved in the diocese and archdiocese in Detroit, coming to become the bishop of the Diocese of Gary, are there any similarities? Are there any differences between the two?
Well, I'd like to think that there are. I, you know, certainly don't want to presume Gary's history to some significant degree. I'll be welcomed, and that'll become my new home very shortly. But I think, to the extent that we're both, part of the industrial Great Lakes, that there are some commonalities. Certainly, the presence of a dominant industry that experienced some transformation and some periods of economic downturns, both in Detroit, heavily reliant on the auto industry, and of course, Gary, historically identified with the steel industry. Our communities can be highly sensitive to economic fluctuations and also, you know, the dislocation that can occur when such economic downturns take place. So having that experience, I hope, will give me a sense of compassion and understanding as I come to Gary. But I would also say, you know, I'm a healthily proud son of Detroit, and I will be a proud son of Gary. And I think sometimes those communities, perhaps, that have had some similar struggles can almost begin to feel a little bit like we're marginalized, and that's certainly not God's plan. God's love is for all of us, and even if the rest of the world doesn't know all the gifts that we have, we know the gifts that we have. And so I really hope to bring a message of encouragement and hopefulness and God's love, and I think some of my experience in Detroit may be transferable into Gary, just having a kind of a sensitivity what it means to be in communities that have gone through those changes and struggles and mm-hmm. come out for the better ultimately because of it.
Are there any special plans that in the meantime that you have thought about between the time that the announcement came out in November and your impending ordination and installation as the bishop? Anything special that you have maybe in mind for the folks here of the Diocese of Gary?
Well, this has been a real time of information gathering for me, of course, planning some of the logistics of the liturgy itself that will be occurring. But as I look beyond February 11th, there are probably about three areas that I think would be good for me to focus on, three or four. I mean, initially, as I said, just being a presence of hope and encouragement. We're in the midst of finalizing a public schedule so that after the 11th, I'll be having the opportunity to have masses or opportunities to be at some significant events throughout the four counties. Beyond that would be really to get to know the needs of the flock in Gary so that I can listen and I can receive and get a deeper appreciation for what the people of Gary might need and want at this time. The third area that I'm very privileged to be able to build upon is that Bishop Hying in 2017 had what's called a diocesan synod, and that's a pretty rare occurrence in the life of a diocese. And so that was a convening of leaders and a time of reflection for the whole Diocese of Gary that occurred in 2017. And so that laid forth some pastoral priorities, some areas that we need to focus on in terms of evangelization and service to others. And so I feel as though that will give me a foundation to be able to reach out and have some guideposts as I begin to minister. And then finally, of course, I'm coming as the Catholic bishop, the Roman Catholic bishop, to the Diocese of Gary, but I also see myself as having a responsibility to be a good member of the wider community, to make sure that people understand that the Catholic Church, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you have another faith or no faith, that we exist to bring to be good neighbors, to bring God's love, and to do our part in the wider community. So that's also something that I see as significant when I come into Gary.
Well, Bishop Robert McClory, thank you very much for speaking with us, and we look forward to having a chance to meet you when you do make your visit and become the new bishop of the Diocese of Gary on February 11th. Thank you for spending some time talking today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. With another edition of Building Northwest Indiana, here's Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to another edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. I'm the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation. Last week, we talked to one of my colleagues, Dr. James Arendis. He is the Director of the Construction Safety Institute at the Construction Advancement Foundation. And we ran out of time, but he's back in studio to join us again. Doctor, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, Kevin. Glad to be here.
So where do you see the future of safety in Northwest Indiana? Is there anything that OSHA's really been cracking down on as far as, you know, this is an area of hazard, we need to be safer in this? I mean, what can our contractors expect for the future here?
There's been rules, and every several years a new rule comes out, or OSHA takes an old rule and revises it to bring it up to today's standards. Right now, one of the newer rules that we've been spending a lot of time with, there's some regulations on silica exposure, which is the dust that would come off of cutting concrete, drilling into concrete, sawing bricks. So in our industry, that's a pretty common exposure. So there's hazards associated with the silica exposures. So a couple of years back, OSHA revised the standard. They brought it up a couple levels, actually. So in our organization, you know, we've taken this very seriously, we're in the second year of receiving grants from OSHA to do training. So there's a grant system that OSHA put together many years ago. It's called the Susan Harwood Grants. And we try at the Construction Advancement Foundation and our Safety Institute, we try to receive grants on an annual basis. And one of the reasons we do that is when we get a grant, and this is kind of maybe a little bit of part of what keeps us ahead of the rest of the country, is our contractors and the owners really embrace it. So we've got training coming in at no cost because we're reimbursed by OSHA themselves. So when we have a grant, we do a lot of training on that subject. We saturate the industry with this knowledge. That's how we keep up with every change. There's been some changes on confined spaces where people work in manholes, vaults, and different kind of confined areas where it could become hazardous to your health. So in the future, you know, I'm sure that over time there's going to be changes to some of the rules and improvements. And what we do is we don't know what those are going to actually be, but we approach them as they come and apply for this training money to get our industry up to speed. And, you know, over the years, our whole industry has become so used to this that, you know, our training costs as an industry are down because the government, OSHA, is supporting us at a pretty high level. We try to anticipate what's coming, but we sometimes have to eat what comes on our plate, you know, to keep our contractors up with the rules. You know, another thing that happens is, you know, if there's an incident, you know, between our customers, the industrial users, and our contractors, we always have a pretty complex discussion about how we can improve ourselves as an industry to reduce that from happening again. And there's a lot of discussion, even on small issues that could have resulted in something really bad. So And the sharing of that information is done through the business roundtable and a lot of the owners. So we share that information and we all elevate ourselves together.
Well, that was a lot of great information, Doctor. I appreciate you joining us today.
Anytime, Kevin.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana. I would like to thank our guest, Dr. James Arendis. He is the director of the Construction Safety Institute at the Construction Advancement Foundation. To find out more information about the Construction Safety Institute, you can visit cafnwin.org.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation, and you can hear Building Northwest Indiana right here on Regionally Speaking every Tuesday here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and the podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story has come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Okay, what I think makes a good neighbor is fences. That's what I think makes a good neighbor. And that sounds mean to say that, but when I was living in Portage, one of my neighbors wanted to put up a fence and next door, and I go, oh, that's a good idea. Why don't you do that? And he put the fence up and I go, that's a great idea. Oh my God, there's a fence. I love this fence. What's this concept called fence? So I go on the other side, I go, I'm putting a fence up the next week. So the same guy who put up a fence over here put a fence there up. I go, I love this idea of fences. I love fences. So yeah, neighbors are great. And I've never had like bad neighbors. I always hear stories from my readers. Yeah, old man Kirkowitz over here, you know, he's making problems and he's got 3 dogs and 10 cats. And I never had a bad neighbor, to be honest with you. But I think we kind of create our own realities in life. And I think we kind of create our own neighbors in a way, too. I was never invasive. I never got in people's ways. Just people leave me alone. That's my general credo in life. Just leave me alone. I'll leave you alone. We'll be good and we'll die. And it's all good. That's my credo. I value my space as much as I value my time. That's why I have a few friends, because time and space are so important to me. So to keep people away from my space, and then you don't have to, they don't infringe not only on your space, but then on those issues that revolve around your space that you have to maybe talk about. Like, can you keep your dog out of my lawn, please? For instance, and that keeps that dialogue gone. You don't have to have that kind of a dialogue. And I like privacy. I'm huge on privacy. It flies in the face of my job, but I'm a very private person. So I think fences are huge. And that's the oxymoron part. Because it's a juxtaposition. It gets in the way, doesn't it? I wrote a column once on the bane of our society, I thought, was attached garages as opposed to detached garages. Because you get home from work, you open your door with an automatic garage door, you go inside, nobody sees you. It's like the bat cave. You know what I mean? As opposed to in the old days, like in the 50s or 60s, you have this attached garage, you get home from work, you drive in the garage, you have to walk into your house. Hey, Fred, how you doing? How was work today? There's no fence there. Jerry didn't have a fence yet. I like bushes, too. Bushes are like fancy fences to me, you know? My point was, I thought these garages, you ruin that. You lose that effect of community. So the idealized version of my world would think, it's great to have that. But the realistic version of my world is like, nah, fences are good. Attached garages, I'm all for it.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. In South Lake County, residents in the Hanover Community School District are going to be asked in the May 5th primary election, a separate item on the ballot, by the way, to approve a capital referendum question. The question is very simple, and there's a lot more behind that than the simple question itself. So we've turned to the source. We're turning to the superintendent of the Hanover Community School District, Mary McCauley, to tell us more about not only the project that the school district is asking to be able to fund, with a lot of things that are on the plate on this one, but the reason behind why all this is needed. And Ms. McCauley, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we'll start out first here, I guess, with the usual questions here, who, what, where, when, why, and all that. First, if you will, tell us a little bit about, and we'll get into the details as to, I guess, a lot of why this is needed, because that's a big part of the question that you're asking residents in the district to help out. But tell us specifically about the capital project itself. We're talking, what, a total of $79 million. It sounds horrendously large, but there's a lot that goes in that, isn't it?
Yes, there is a lot that goes into it, and it includes all 4 of our buildings. Primarily, it addresses our issue with our increasing enrollment, because we are one of the fastest growing districts in the state. And our ADM, which is our average daily membership, has just increased each year For example, this year we're at 2,444 students. The year before we were at 2,381. The year before that, 2,293. So each year we have seen our enrollment go up, and there is so much building around the area. So we have run out of space. Part of the building project includes building a new upper elementary building so that we can move some of the children out of our existing elementary buildings and move the fifth grade out of the middle school. We moved the fifth grade to the middle school a couple of years ago with the hopes of freeing up some space at the elementaries. The only thing that did was they filled in that space almost immediately. So we are just jam-packed, and we now have two mobile classrooms in our district.
I understand that in the, we'll say, the last 4 years, you've added 500 students to the enrollment there in the school district, and like added even 33 just coming out of the holiday break. Is it amazing that you would pick up so many extra students in just a short period of time?
No, the houses are going up quicker than we can keep on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
To get an idea of just all of the planned and platted neighborhoods, approximately 27 more homes are planned out here. So we didn't anticipate quite the growth that we're seeing. We had a demographer out several years ago, but this has far surpassed what we had anticipated. So we have to, last year the referendum failed, so we did some things differently as far as going out to the community, being more proactive. We've done a couple of surveys. We've done something called Thought Exchange, where we've asked the community to weigh in on what they think we need to be attentive to as far as our facilities. And that is how this whole $79 million project came into being.
Now, for folks that are not all that familiar with the Hanover Community School District, most of the school district really encompasses around Cedar Lake, but there's some areas on all sides, I guess, that's part of the district, right?
Correct. We have people that live in Dyer. We have people that live in St. John, Crown Point address. So we service a large range.
When you take a look at such a large, physically large school district, and the schools that are spread out, of course, to be able to serve all these residents, you have to try to plan for the future, I suppose. And you've had to be able to make up, of course, with all this added enrollment. I understand you've even had to add some portable classrooms at some of the schools as well.
That's absolutely correct. We have a portable classroom at Lincoln Elementary because there are no classrooms left. We have a portable classroom at Hanover Central Middle School. Over at the middle school, we have more kids now than we do at the high school. So the mobile classroom is necessary because we have teachers on carts going room to room. We have teacher lounges that are being utilized, plan rooms. There is just absolutely no available space.
When it was time to be able to, and we had a lot of consultation, I know, with the financial experts as well as with your principals and the teachers and everybody on the staff of the school district, when it was time to put all this information together, what kind of material did you have to present, certainly to the school board, because they have to buy into it as well. They're just as much a part of it as well as everybody who works for the school district officially. What kind of effort did you have to make with the school board to let them know, if they haven't already known, obviously, how important this is? And also, too, to talk about the cost to the taxpayers, because they're going to have to, I'm sure, do a lot of this selling, so to speak, by themselves.
Correct. Well, we had to share the information as far as our enrollment, how much it has grown since 2012. In addition to that, we shared plans about where the new building would be located, what would be included in that, how we can address the needs of the high school, because these kids are all going to matriculate to the high school, how we can do some renovations there to address tech, college and career, and technology, trades classes, et cetera. Had to share that. We had to talk about how our AV continues to go up. Last year, it increased by 10%. This has become a destination district. People truly want to be here and raise their families here. We have an exceptional school system. In addition to that, we had to share with, and bond counsel was very helpful, and the board has been so supportive. We had architects come in and look at our facilities. We've also talked about how the debt can be structured so it has minimal impact to the taxpayer until that debt falls off. And the board has been integral to this every step of the way.
Now, I understand that I'm not sure if it is out there on the website as we speak, but I'm sure that if it isn't, it will be soon, that you're going to have a referendum tax calculator put onto the Hanover Community School Corporation website so that people who go onto the website, which, by the way, is hanover.k12.in.us, will be able to put in their own figures as to how much the property value happens to be for their house or commercial or business property or whatever it may be, and see what kind of impact the referendum would have, the project in general actually would have based on the referendum.
Correct. And we anticipate that'll be up next week.
Wow. So, I guess you can't start too soon, to be sure, and certainly because you have only till May, and have everybody to be aware of this. It's really, really quite a kind of a harried situation you folks are in right now, right?
It absolutely is, and that tax calculator. What's nice about that is the average taxpayer can enter in their information, and it'll tell them exactly to the penny what they'll be paying. We also have a finance director who has met with taxpayers who've brought in their tax statements. We will meet with anyone who asks to meet with us. We're being very forthright and open. We don't want any surprises.
I know you've gone through this procedure before. The school district has gone through this procedure before and unfortunately did not get the support from the voters that time around. What is different this time around with the project? Is it the scale of the project itself? Is it the tax rate, or is there some other factors that come into it? Or is it really just the realization that we're such a growing school district, we need to have the help right now?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think it is the realization that we are a growing district, and all you have to do is drive around the area and you can see homes going up everywhere. The other thing that I think we did, it was such a harried procedure last year, but what we did, we took a step back after it failed. It failed by 68 votes. So we took a long, hard look at, okay, what did we do? What can we do differently? And we were upfront as far as getting as much community input as we could. We wanted to know their thoughts. In addition to that, we've done community forums. We have more community forums scheduled. We surveyed surveyed the community. So I think there was a lot more ownership in this.
Well, Superintendent McCauley, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. We hope to have you on again as we get closer to the day that the referendum question will be out there for voters in the Hanover Community School Corporation for them to see. And we hope that if people have questions, they can go on the website, get the information, the answers to their questions, and hopefully they will be able to go into the polling place there in the Cedar Lake area a bit more informed than they might have been the last time around. And we wish you all the best of luck on this.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, you're very welcome. Mary McCauley is the superintendent of the Hanover Community School Corporation, and voters are being asked in the Hanover Community School Corporation to approve a question that'll be on the May 5th ballot that in turn would approve a $79 million capital project. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The month of February is American Heart Month. It's an opportunity to find out more about the awareness of having a very sound heart health. It's an opportunity as well for the American Heart Association to come forth to the public and promote the various initiatives they have. And to tell us more about not only American Heart Month and the importance here in Northwest Indiana, but I'm sure some of the events that are going to be happening within the month, Connie Adams is with the Methodist Hospitals. She's a heart specialist on staff there, and she is a representative of the Northwest Indiana Heart Association. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
If you will, take a little time, tell us about the importance of American Heart Month in general.
Well, I'm so excited to be able to talk about this because it's a topic very near and dear to my heart, February is American Heart Month. And in fact, on Friday, go red in support of National Wear Red Day. Heart disease is the number one killer of Americans. It's the number one killer of women, more than any form of cancer, all form of cancers combined. Heart disease in women affects all ages. In fact, we're seeing a rise in the number of heart attacks in younger women in their 20s and 30s. So this is really a call to action that women can take control of their lives and their heart health, as well as their families and their loved ones, through, it could be as simple as 7 key factors for ideal heart health.
Mm-hmm.
And these can include, the first one that I'm going to mention is something that people do daily, multiple times a day. We eat. So our diets, the American diet, is not necessarily the most heart healthy, but it's something you can definitely control. You control the types of foods and drinks that you put in your mouth. So staying away from sugary drinks such as sodas can have a great impact on keeping your body weight down, controlling blood sugar for people who are diabetic or have a new term we're hearing more and more is pre-diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So eating foods that are heart healthy, less processed, less fried, fatty, more foods in their natural form, like vegetables, salads, nuts, fruits, and eating less of the red meats and especially fried foods. Exercise. So we see a lot of people, especially here at the hospital, who have fitness devices so that can help you track when you need to get up and move around. The American Heart Association recommends at least taking 10,000 steps a day, and it's hard to put a number on that unless you've got a fitness device. For some people, it helps them to keep track of, well, I've spent a little too much time behind my computer, I need to get up and move around. And by keeping track of your exercise, it helps you to keep your body weight in a heart-healthy way, because the more there are many Americans who are overweight, and that contributes to other problems as far in addition to heart health. We see people who've got high cholesterol who are overweight, but we also see high cholesterol in people who are underweight. So that brings home another point, know your numbers.
Mm-hmm. Is that in that particular case, that may be hereditary too, right? It's not always what you eat or don't eat. Maybe that can determine whether you have cholesterol problems.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a great point, because you can't always tell by looking at people. You see somebody who's skinny and they look like they're really fit, but they may have the genes for high cholesterol. So the only way to know that is to get your cholesterol checked. And we're really encouraging women, even in their 20s, to know their numbers. And by knowing your numbers, I'm talking about knowing your weight and your body mass index, or BMI, your blood pressure, cholesterol, blood sugar. If you smoke, there's so many things we can do to help people quit smoking, whether it's medicine or a patch or just encouragement to quit. It can all impact women's heart health.
Now, I know that the idea of National, or actually American Heart Month, I should say, started back in 1964, so it's been around for more than 50 years, in fact, getting close to 60 now. But it's only been, I guess, in the last, last decade and a half or so that the Go Red for Women movement's gone?
It's true. And part of the reason for that was in the 1960s, even in the 50s, when research started to focus on heart disease and heart attacks, it focused on white men. And women in particular were not part of research studies, so not a lot was known. And now that we know a lot more about women and heart health, the good news is about 80% of those heart attacks are preventable by plugging into those 7 key factors I talked about: the diet, exercise, body weight, cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, and smoking.
I understand, too, that the American Heart Association does a lot of research work or supports a lot of research work around the country and here in Indiana, too. I understand that about $5 million comes from the American Heart Association that helps support programs and research here in Indiana. The university, IU in particular, is a beneficiary of this.
Well, that's good to know. And I encourage anybody, not only women but men, even minorities, women of color, to get involved. If you hear about a research study, get involved, because the more we know about being heart healthy, the more we can impact other people in the future. And research is one great way to do that and to close or reduce disparities, both gender and race-wise. So there's a lot of opportunities for us to be more heart healthy. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, since heart disease is the number one killer of Americans, we know a lot, but there's still a lot we don't know. And getting or encouraging people to plug into these heart healthy things so that we can move the needle, not be the number one killer of Americans, not be the number one killer of women.
We've talked a lot here so far about American Heart Month and the importance of heart health awareness. Let's talk a little bit more about the Go Red for Women program, the initiative that's underway that the Heart Association's established. It hits locally. In fact, there is a local event that is coming up on Friday of this week in Valparaiso, where I guess it kicks off really the start of the whole month, isn't it?
That is. So in Porter County, the Go Red for Women luncheon. And there will be things throughout Lake County in the future, too. So part of the importance of these events, and if you're able to attend, please do. If you've ever been to a Go Red event, we talk to many women, and they say it's really made an impact on their life. Because if they haven't been impacted by heart disease, they know someone who has. So one of the things we really talk about is, I mean, in addition to heart health, is knowing signs and symptoms of a heart attack. It's the reality in our times and where we live.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this event coming up here on Friday the 7th? It's National Wear Red Day anyway. That's the big overall important point of this. But I know there's also the Valparaiso-based Go Red for Women event. Can you tell us a little bit more about the event coming up?
Well, there will be a number of speakers talking about heart health and women who will talk about their personal journeys that usually started with some significant cardiovascular event, either a heart attack or, unfortunately, a stroke. So there will be screening available, blood pressure screening, heart disease risk factor screenings, as well as a heart-healthy lunch. So we practice what we preach and help you to taste that healthy heart food can be very delicious. In addition, there'll be education in the Go Red events, and American Heart does a lot with educating the public. But in this particular one on Friday, it'll be focused on women. And there will also be men in the audience because heart disease affects all people.
So, I think that's a good idea to bring, and for wives to bring their husbands along or other family members along if they either have problems or they have potential for problems. Yes,
that's correct. That's correct. So big focus on education. So when ladies and their significant others leave this event on Friday, they should walk out knowing not only the statistics. I mean, the reality is it's heart disease is a big deal. But more empowering is knowing what you can do not to be one of those statistics. So awareness about diet, your exercise, and what you can do to prevent heart disease.
We've talked here about the Go Red events coming up here on Friday the 7th, at least the one that's going to happen in Valparaiso. First thing you tell us, we had mentioned where it's going to be, and if anybody's interested in attending, if they need to get reservations for it.
I'm going to have to get back with you on that.
Okay, I wasn't sure. It's going to be held, I know, in Valparaiso, and there's more information, I'm sure, that's on the American Heart Association, the regional website, so we can have that, leave it at that as well. And I just understand that this is a great opportunity, like I said, not only for heart health awareness, but also to get family members together. It may be an opportunity to bring mother or grandmother together with daughters and certainly sons if they're attending the event.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And wearing red. So in this event, we see a sea of red. We see all these lovely ladies wearing red. And that's just a testament to the importance of heart disease awareness.
Well, Connie, thank you for spending time with us to explain not only the importance of American Heart Month, but also the overall initiative, Go Red for Women, and some of the events that are coming up here in Northwest Indiana as well, which is the one coming up Friday in Valparaiso. We appreciate you taking time to explain things and hope that you have a good event coming up on Friday as well, too.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for having me on today.
You're welcome. Connie Adams is a specialist with Methodist Hospitals, and she's also a representative with us today with the American Heart Association talking about National American Heart Month, which is the month of February. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.